Welcome to Friday. Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. We're on Twitter at KUOW here at the end of the week to figure out what happened and what it means. And I have help because with me today, Kathy Allen, political consultant, founder, president of the Connections Group. Hi, Kathy.
Good morning.
Zaki Barak Hamid, program manager, Humanities Washington. Great to see you again.
Thank you. And he's director, too, not manager.
Director. Ooh. Program director?
Idols matter, my friend.
They do.
That's great. That's
executive director?
Oh, no.
Okay. No,
that's my boss.
That's too grand. Got it. Rob McKenna, former attorney general of the state of Washington. Good to see you again, Rob.
Thanks, Bill.
Thanks for coming. So this week was the deadline for cities to submit their bid to be Amazon's second headquarters. Some local leaders, including a majority of Seattle City Council members, wrote Jeff Bezos a letter obtained by the Seattle Times saying, if Amazon's decision was based on their feeling unwelcome in Seattle or not being included in some of our regional decisions, we would like to hit the refresh button, end of quote. This letter also said, quote, you have heard mixed messages from our community, whether it stems from comments in our local newspapers or comments from elected officials who have differing views and positions that are less than collaborative. Democratic State Senator Guy Palumbo signed on to that letter, and he told me this week, we're not being fair to Amazon.
They're blamed for the traffic, they're blamed for housing prices, they're blamed for gentrification, they're blamed for homelessness, you know, you name it, they're blamed for it.
Not signing the letter was City Council member Shama Sawant, who called the letter disingenuous and craven. Who's right here?
Probably neither.
Yeah.
Probably
safe bet?
I think, yeah, it's a pretty safe bet that in all of this, when you are feeling bad about traffic or the rain's coming or the Mariners didn't win and we're still sitting here trying to figure out what's going on, we need to blame someone. And, you know, here are all these rather young international people walking downtown with their dogs and you're going, oh, they work at Amazon. They're part of the Amazon crowd. But the fact is that I think that we've done is just made up somebody that we can blame. We're pretty good at that.
Zaki?
Yeah. I agree to a certain extent. Here's what I think is really interesting about this. Jeff Bezos goes and acts like this big king and talks to his subjects and say, please, wow me with your amazing offers.
Is that what a king does?
In certain
this is
places,
negotiating, maybe. Isn't he?
Well, I don't think he's negotiating. He is offering something, which is great. I mean, 50,000 jobs is nothing to blink at. But it's interesting because I don't think there's any doubt in my mind, at least, that the most powerful entities in the U.S. are corporations. It's certainly not the people. It's not politicians. It's certainly not the president of the United States. It is corporations. They get to demand whatever they want, and cities, almost 150, are stumbling over each other to try to get this. We'll give you whatever you want. We'll fight a bear. We'll name a town after you. Whatever it is, we'll send a cactus your way.
You won't have to spend any money. You know, well, we'll just let you come here.
Right. Yeah. And I don't think commerce is bad, but I just think this is a commentary on our system.
Well, what about Seattle? Rob McKenna, do you think the threat of Amazon leaving Seattle or shrinking in Seattle because they can do better elsewhere. Do you think that could turn Seattle's liberal politics more business friendly? No income tax, no employee head tax.
Well, they've moved so far away from being business friendly in the view of a lot of people I know in business that anything almost would be an improvement. And I think they are now genuinely worried about whether or not Amazon feels like it's no longer welcome here. And this is not an experience that's new to us. We've already seen Boeing move its headquarters to Chicago, for example. We've seen them open a major manufacturing facility in South Carolina. I remember vividly when Frank Schrantz was CEO and they had such a hard time and spent so much money getting approvals to expand the Everett plant and add a lot of jobs up there that he said publicly, in a speech, this is the last major facility we will ever build in the Seattle area. And, you know, what happens, and this is why we don't learn our lesson, is that the economy goes down, then it comes back up. And when the economy is down, everyone's saying jobs, 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 economic development, what can we do? When the economy is roaring, we treat growth like a problem. Growth is not a problem. The metaphor I always use is that people treat growth in a high growth environment like a river that's threatening to overrun its banks. Economic growth and the jobs it brings is more like a wellspring that needs to be nurtured and taken care of. And Seattle hasn't been doing that.
But what if Amazon takes its job somewhere else? So if you're here and you want to work for Amazon, you go somewhere else and it's less expensive and less congested here, and people go on with their lives as they did before Amazon was here. What's so bad about that?
Well, if it results in a major loss of jobs, there's a lot that's wrong with it, because we're not just talking about the jobs that Amazon directly creates. We're talking about a lot of other jobs that are created because of the wealth that Amazon creates. We saw this happen with Boeing. East Bellevue was built for Boeing engineers. We saw this with Microsoft. Redmond and other areas in the East Side and in Seattle have done very, very well because of the wealth Microsoft has created. And now we're seeing it with Amazon. So we're talking about people in restaurants losing their jobs, carpenters not having as many remodel jobs to do on homes. There's a huge cascading effect, which is exactly why other cities, including very progressive cities, are going to work quite hard to attract Amazon to their jurisdiction, just as Chicago successfully did with the Boeing headquarters.
I don't know. Kind of seems like you're getting into Halloween spookiness kind of early, don't you think? I got to say that in all of it, it's when Macy's decides when they're going to actually put four more floors of Amazon people after six new buildings downtown. I'm sitting there going, well, it can't be that bad that they're starting to move out when they're taking all of these new buildings just this week.
Yeah, they got a new skyscraper coming.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like, and I have to say that I worry about it being more of just a one company town. I worry more about that Boeing break, that what happens is that you become so reliant on just an Amazon income and all of the actual jobs it feeds. But what happens is that you don't have the diversity of another or several other larger companies. And that's where you get in trouble. You become beholden to someone who says, well, if I don't get another 7%, decrease in my taxes here, I'm going to have to leave. I'm going to South Carolina.
But they haven't made any demands like that, Kat.
By the way, Boeing
did, though.
Boeing moved jobs even despite the tax breaks.
They're not demanding that they get tax cuts from Seattle in order to stay. And they're not saying we're going to pull out from what we have. They're saying we're not going to grow here. We're going to grow somewhere else. That's the first thing that happens. And then down the line, if things don't improve, from their point of view, then they might actually start moving jobs out. And I think we'll regret that when it happens. These are high paying jobs that are not smokestack jobs, obviously. And they also are jobs that create not only other jobs of the type I just mentioned, like people in the construction trades and service economy, but other companies come here to be near Amazon's talent. Bezos came here to Seattle because Microsoft was here and he saw there was a lot of software talent that he could take advantage of. So again, unless we think that all these other cities are crazy for wanting this very successful company and all the economic growth it brings to come to them, maybe we're the ones who are being arrogant and should start listening more.
Zeki, we're talking about economic growth. What about Seoul? Tim Egan in the New York Times today was just the latest person to say, and this was the headline that Tim Egan probably didn't write, but the headline was how Amazon took Seoul. Yes, economic growth. Yes. Has, in the meantime, Amazon taken our soul?
I'm not sure if it's taken our soul. I know that our city is changing rapidly, and that's part of the problem. If a quick change like that happens, there's going to be an equal reaction to it that's very negative. But my concern is this growth equitable? That's what I'm thinking about. There's a lot of people that come out on the losing end. Anytime a corporation bargains with a city, they have the upper hand, and the community that lives there doesn't. So all the people that are being displaced, whether they are forced outside city limits to live there, whether they can't afford their home anymore, end up in homelessness, is this growth equitable? And can we have laws that make sure that this growth is equitable? Right now, it doesn't seem like it because corporations always have the upper hand. So, and I'm not advocating, solely for, higher taxes or anything like that. I just pose the question.
But then you're blaming the politicians for letting corporations have the upper hand, not Amazon, for doing its job.
Sure, because Amazon would just leave. I think they're forced into a certain corner.
But are they forced? This is the question. Amazon has brought a lot of jobs and money. But does that mean that politicians are forced to accommodate and attract that growth?
Well, they're clearly our politicians in Seattle don't think that. I mean, you've got Councilmember O'Brien talking about an employee head tax now. Other taxes have been raised, et cetera. So, no, I don't think they feel like they're forced to do it. I agree with Zeki that, you know, when you have a growing company, it creates things like higher housing prices because more people are there who are making a lot of money to compete for the housing. But I think you have to keep in mind what the alternative is. Mm. The alternative is not having economic growth, not having well-paying jobs, not having opportunity for our kids. I can't tell you the number of young people I know who've gone to work for Amazon, didn't have to leave the Northwest. But on the other hand, my parents are from Iowa, and I know lots and lots and lots of people who have left the Midwest trying to find jobs, going elsewhere to find those jobs, and leaving their communities. I think we're extraordinarily fortunate, notwithstanding the effects, Zeki, that you point out, that the secondary effects that this growth can have.
Kathy, here's how Tim Egan in the New York Times describes soullessness. The character of Seattle, a rain-loving communal shrug, has changed. Now we're a city on amphetamines.
If only, right. I would say no in all of this. What's happened is that, we're talking about Seattle potentially just being a great metaphor for what goes on all over the country at different times in different places. The fact I look at it is that, we're going through the good times now, but it's not equitable growth at all. But at the same time, it's not the horrid we hate all business that Rob's talking about. I mean, we don't hate business here. Is our city council the best example of the most, what I would say, cuddly council for corporations? No, they're not the most, but they definitely are among the most, I would say, vocal when it comes to trying to get more than perhaps their fair share. I think that's fair to say, too. When it comes to the whole overall, I just think that, we got the goods now. I'm more inclined to think that someone like Bezos doesn't really remind me of the usual corporate thug. What he reminds me of is someone who says, okay, give me a good idea. Give me a good idea. This guy seems to be addicted more to, all right, give me a good idea. If you can get me a good idea, I mean, there's a part of me that thinks he's going to ask for all these great old ideas, steal them, and stay here.
Yes.
I just think he might be the most powerful man in America right now.
Before we leave Amazon, I still want to try to talk about amphetamines and soul. I think Tim Egan is saying that when you work a lot because your job demands it and you have gadgets that you can work with all the time, and a lot of money is at stake for you because it pays well, that you start to think that your job matters more than it does, and you neglect the people you love, you neglect the parts of you that are not about your job, you stop doing communal things that make your neighborhood and your town a better place. You no longer have people with their families and neighbors because they're commuting from a cheaper suburb. I think that's what he means by losing its soul. Do you think that's fair? Is that Amazon's problem? Should we care? If we're enjoying the amphetamines, hey, life is good.
No, we should definitely care. Community is the heart of any city or state or country. It's all about these communities. We should absolutely care.
And you think
about
that's happening in Seattle?
I think this is happening worldwide. I think this is just a symptom of technology and what is happening. So I don't know if this is specific to Seattle. Just because Seattle has a big company like Amazon is successful, I don't think it puts it apart than mm-hmm. other places of that size. I mean, if you go, say, to Yakima, or you go to Spokane or any of these, yeah, sure, life is a little slower, but that's just a symptom of, the urban and rural divide.
That's Zeki Barak Hamid, director at Humanities Washington, with former Attorney General Rob McKenna, political consultant from the Connections Group, Kathy Allen, and we're figuring out what happened this week and why. We've got a lot more to talk about on the Week in Review. Who gets to vote on supervised injection sites? How much did you care about political endorsements? Is the Harvey Weinstein affair changing anything much? All of that and more coming up. KUOW's Week in Review. We're on Twitter at KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. We were just talking about Amazon, and I forgot to tell you about KUOW's new podcast, Primed. It's all about what happens when Amazon comes to your town. And you can listen to the first episode right now, wherever you get your podcasts. Now, Week in Review with Rob McKenna, Kathy Allen, Zeki Barak Hamid. And our next topic is, how much do you need to know about drugs and public health to get to vote on the matter? King County is proposing there be places where you can bring in illegal drugs and take them under medical supervision. Some opponents want to put that to a vote. Some supporters say, no, this is a public health matter. For public health experts, you don't get to vote on it. And this week, a King County judge agreed with that. Putting these supervised injection sites to a vote would infringe on the power of the King County Board of Health. Anybody disagree?
Well, I have a lot of experience with these questions, so let me go first. Uh-huh. I was Attorney General. At least twice, there were statewide ballot measures which qualified for the ballot. They gathered enough signatures. And prior to the election, the opponents to those measures went to court to block them from the ballot, to deny voters an opportunity to actually take the vote, instead of stepping aside, letting the voters have their say, and then, if they saw legal defects in the measures, bringing the lawsuits then. In both the cases that I clearly recall, we won 9-0 Supreme Court rulings in favor of allowing the measures to proceed to the ballot. And I think that's the right policy. Let the voters have their say. If the measure is struck down, then at least you have an advisory ballot. You have a sense of what the voters want. That actually has happened a couple of times. For example, Initiative 747 regarding property taxes, Initiative 694 regarding motor vehicle tabs. Both those measures were subsequently struck down by the court, and both those measures were subsequently reenacted with the legal defects fixed by the legislature. They said, we heard the voters, we're going to pass these measures into law. What Judge Galvan said in this case was that you can't make budget decisions by a ballot measure. That may be correct, but of course, a remedy to that would be to simply strike that provision from the measure, not to keep the measure from going to the ballot at all. And she said that the Board of Health has exclusive power over these decisions. I'm not sure that's true. And I think that's a question that should have been allowed to, you know, be decided after the vote. Let the voters have their say, and then you can deal with it afterwards. Otherwise, it's too much of the courts interfering with a democratic process.
And this will be appealed as well. Does anybody disagree? Do you? Yes, Zeki.
I'm just not a big fan of initiatives, period. I think they're overused. I think they are often voted on by voters who are underinformed. An issue like this deserves a lot of debate, a lot of thought, research, much more than just two paragraphs in a voter's guide that somebody's just going to throw in the recycling bin as soon as they get it anyways.
So would you do away with the initiative process if you could?
I would. I'm not a fan.
Couple things. I'm sorry.
Nice
Kathy.
Try.
Go ahead.
I'm going to say nice try, but the fact is that the voters love it for reasons which are still pretty incredulous to most of us. I would just simply say that this issue, we can get bogged down into the legalities of it. But when you're asking the general public to vote for something like illegal drugs in your backyard at a time when right now drug addiction and drug use is huge, the fact is that you can't expect the majority of people, families, kids, you can't expect them to learn the ins and outs of this in 9 seconds or 9 weeks. The fact is that this suffers dangerously close to it may indeed be the best thing we could do for the people affected. But in my opinion, the voters are absolutely right now totally against it. And they're against it because you're telling them there's going to be illegal drugs that they would like to think can't even be bought on the streets that are going to actually be allowed to be handed out there. This is not something that should be on the ballot, period.
Because voters are so wrong or because?
No, because voters need time to be able to understand this. It is not different from what we saw just last year and the year before, which had to do with trans use of bathrooms. Now, there are so many progressives that told me, well, you know, we got to vote for this because everyone, you know, we're all pro-trans. This is a good thing for progressive types. And our progressive friends, last year in the presidential election with Hillary, one of the things that became very evident to me is that we were losing votes based on the fact that she was saying that, yes, well, of course we support this because we're, you know, we're all for one and one for all in a great progressive cause. However, the public was not caught up on the information. And it's a disservice to the people to go ahead and throw these things at voters at a time when they have no idea what it is, and it just sounds dreadful.
Well, a couple of points, Bill. Number one, some of the most cherished laws in our state, cherished by conservatives, like, you know, requiring the legislature to have a two-thirds majority in place to adopt tax increases. Measures beloved by good government advocates like the Public Records Act, the Public Meetings Act, and other good government reforms. Measures beloved to the left like a higher minimum wage. All of the product of popular initiative. All of them.
Legal marijuana, which you could also argue is a public health matter. That went to a statewide vote.
Exactly right. So I don't agree with the idea that voters shouldn't have this power, because they gave themselves this power through constitutional amendment in the early 1900s. And B, even assuming for the sake of argument voters make mistakes sometimes and vote into law bad policies, none of them is permanent, because all of them simply are another method of enacting either a state law or a local ordinance, which can be amended in the case of a state law immediately with supermajorities in the state legislature and within 2 years by simple majorities. It's just another way to pass laws. If they make mistakes, they can be corrected. And the third and last point I'll make is I think voters are capable of deciding whether or not taxpayer dollars should be used to fund clinics in which people take illegal drugs like heroin. I mean, they have a right to make these decisions, and just like they had a right to legalize marijuana. And I think it's a little paternalistic to suggest that they can't make the right decision here because they don't know enough.
Well, we just need to figure out how to make sure that the public is well informed and that the public is actually participating. I mean, these voting numbers that we're getting in are abysmal for a lot of times. When you have 40% deciding what is right or wrong for everybody, taking your point, we just need to figure out how to make the public informed and how to increase participation of voters.
Well, a better informed public is clearly a good goal, and it's what we should always be aiming for. But I don't think that somehow discredits everything the voters vote on. I mean, you can't control how well informed they are in advance, but there are checks and balances in the system that can correct it if the voters happen to get it wrong. I don't think they're getting it wrong here, and the polling that I've seen shows that 80% of King County residents are opposed to taxpayer-funded heroin injection clinics.
Actually, I think it's more like 71, but it's still pretty hefty. Mm-hmm. And I would say that it is right now. I just think that it does, to me, border on something that the health community can step in on. But I also feel the same way that we could have had the same situation when it comes to legalized pot, too. And that didn't happen. I think that when we see this is all about really the symbols, and nothing more symbolic in terms of our drug problem probably than heroin, much less legalized heroin. So I'm saying that this is one of those where actually the words as well as the current and existing information people have has already decided this issue. So in my opinion, it's not necessarily one that we should spend a lot of legal dollars on.
By the way, Kathy, before we went on the air, I was saying, boy, what position are you in if you want there to be supervised injection sites, but you also think the public ought to get to vote for it, but you think the public's probably going to vote down these sites that you like? Oh. And Kathy said, oh, yeah, that's a consistency thing. That's big with men.
Yeah, it's a big deal for guys.
What did you mean by that?
We've just done, obviously, an awful lot of work from the National Women's Political Caucus perspective on the differences between how men and women vote. And I don't think it'll surprise you that usually what happens with guys is they look for something that puts it as close to consistent with what they've done in the past. And as soon as you get to that point where you're talking consistency with what I did before, then they're good. They're done. They're ready to move on. And that, please don't make this a longer meeting. Please don't make this a longer discussion. I really want to go to dinner. When it comes to
just tell me what I already thought before.
That's it. And women are far more into, but is it the right thing? And so women are far more interested in getting as much information. And that's why they're more reticent to actually vote until they talked to the people, had the public hearings, read the material. They're much more into, well, I want the whole story. I don't just want to get something that makes me feel safe, that makes me feel I'm consistent. Women are not necessarily consistent, which I know is a surprise to you, Bill.
We men call that flip-flopping with a deep bass voice in a political ad. Although Kathy Allen is a political consultant. She knows a little something about the electorate. In case you're wondering, Kathy Allen, Rob McKenna, Zeki Barak Hamid. And on the topic of elections, Kathy, as a campaign consultant, you have sought political endorsements. Rob McKenna, you've received political endorsements. Zeki, you're a very active voter. This week, the Seattle Times endorsed John Grant for city council candidate, which could be surprising since the Times editorial board is seen as center-right by Seattle standards, and John Grant is a socialist. The Times focused on Grant's take on how the city gets people into housing. But Grant's opponent is Teresa Mosqueda, and The Stranger, which, by the way, also endorsed John Grant, is suggesting that the Times endorsement has to do with Grant's being a white man. Then there's the possibility that organizations endorse candidates as a way to play or pander to their customers or their memberships. So my question is, Kathy, how seriously should we voters take political endorsements?
Usually what people do is they take a look at the endorsements that are listed in the voter pamphlet. And when you see somebody that you know that you voted for before, you look at this and say, well, I could do this if I don't want to do any more work. It's really
those are the consistent men you're talking
those
about?
Those guys that I'm talking about all the time.
Okay.
But when it comes right down to it, it's really that people take a look at endorsements making it as easy for them. Again, all politics is about how do you make it easy for voters to choose one or the other.
Should we take endorsements as our guide?
Well, it depends.
I have done this. I have printed out multiple endorsements, and then I just lay them out in front of me. And where if I don't know the race, if I don't know the people in the race, because I'm an uninformed, lazy voter, that and everyone is and people from the left across the spectrum of endorsers are consistent, I think, yeah, that's probably a responsible person. Is that just a terrible way to approach voting?
No, that is
voting?
Just awesomely a lot of work. And it's probably – it would take less time for you just to actually get informed on the folks or invite them on
– Rather than wait by the printer, I should actually learn something.
But I also think that when it comes to how you choose, now we find a pattern of people who are looking for candidates that are willing to cross the line and actually – either you're going to say something, I'm not a member of any political party, or I really believe that we should have people who could actually cross the line. And be able to cross the aisle. Cross the aisle appears in more of the voter pamphlets this year than it ever has.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, endorsements are, I think, are really important for smaller races. You know, big national races, you already know who you're going to vote for, president, all of that. But when it comes to certain things, especially like judges and stuff like that, I definitely use the endorsements because I have no idea. I pick up something I trust and kind of go down the list. I had somebody come to my door the other day because I live in Shoreline, campaigning for a certain candidate for city council, and I just looked at who's endorsing her. It's like, oh, so-and-so, then she's got my vote. And that's so they're important for some of the small races.
Rob, is that a good idea to figure, I trust this publication for whatever reason or this organization, so I'll trust their endorsement?
We do it all the time. You know, we listen to who our friends are endorsing when there are judges on the ballot. Every lawyer I know and me, we get calls from people saying, I don't know who to vote for judge. What do you think?
By the way, this is rare, isn't it, that in Washington we elect our judges? That's not most places in the country. So you might be a newcomer here and not even know that you're going to be voting on.
It's common in the West, in the states that really came of age in the progressive era.
17 states actually have elected judges.
There you go.
17. Thank you.
Thank you.
You were saying?
So I was saying Kathy knows everything. So yes. This is good. Thank you for that data point.
19 actually have initiative capacity, and where it's very much in the minority still, and yet this idea of initiatives.
Yeah.
But what isn't in the minority is, gentlemen, if you don't have a lot of time, actually, Rob, you probably know a lot of the judges and lawyers. But so if you're looking at a list of people running for judge and you haven't got time to go check the voter pamphlet and there's one woman, Saki.
I always vote for the woman. Absolutely.
Yeah, the evidence is that if you're a female in a judicial race in this county anyway, you have a much better chance of being elected. And we've seen races where there are three or four people running, including one woman, and she'll get over 50% of the vote. Or, you know,
If there are four guys, if there are four women running and one guy, not the same. So indeed, what does happen here, and this is the irony and the humor, if you want to call it that, and that is for the longest time, more men have been voting for women for Superior Court judges than women have been voting for Superior Court judges. That has changed this year.
I want to know, Zeki, why do you vote for women to be judge?
Because he knows they're smarter. What's the matter with
you? Is
that
it?
I teach my daughter that the women are smarter. I always play that song, Grateful Dead song, to her. You know, the women are smarter, that's right. I'm always playing that song. She's 4 years old, so always let her know, your dad doesn't know anything. It's all about your mom.
Isn't that a little bigoted? I understand the reasons, but really, do you want to tell your...
It is. What I do really is, to me, it's the tiebreaker. So if I have two candidates that I really like their views, and they are closely aligned with mine, the tiebreaker is always for the woman for me, because I think there are way too many men in politics, way too many men are making the decisions. I want women to have a voice, and if I can help that with my vote, then so be it.
Well, more women go to law school than men. We're seeing more and more women, you know, becoming partners in law firms. Still not enough, but good progress compared to where we used to be. And more and more women are on the bench. I mean, a majority of my senior managers in the Attorney General's office were women, and several of them have gone on to be appointed or elected to the bench. And this is maybe a place where electing our judges is a good thing, because voters do have a marked preference for female candidates, unless they have other reasons to vote for the other candidate.
Right.
So are you okay with that, Rob, voting for a judge that you don't know because the judge is a woman?
I'd like to have more information than that, and just base it on gender. That does seem like a little bit of a dart shot against the wall. So, but as a lawyer who knows a lot of other lawyers and knows the judiciary, I do have access to more information or perspective. So more often than not, I'm casting an informed, I think it's a relatively informed vote based on qualifications and positions and so forth. But I've seen a lot of judges. The women judges I know are by and large very, very good, but not all of them are, just like not all the men are. So it's good to have more information.
Kathy, any final word on that before we move on?
No, other than we appreciate it, guys.
Just one last thing. I don't know what's up with the Seattle Times. I mean, they endorsed Rob, and now they're endorsing John Grant. I don't know what's going on there.
What's dogs happening? And cats sleeping together. Well,
Rain is falling upward.
I'll tell you what happened. I mean, it's very simple. They had a binary choice. Right, they had two candidates in front of them. Which of these two? They could have opted out and said, "We're not going to endorse either one," but they made a reasoned decision to support Grant. And the reason principally seems to be he's willing to ask questions and challenge things that don't seem to be working, like current housing policies or homelessness policies. So that's a reasonable. It's a good reason to pick him, I think.
I also think that there's an outlier perspective in the Times this year, particularly. We watch a lot about the Municipal League ratings, and we also watch the Seattle Times, particularly if there's anything that the Seattle Times and the Stranger agree with. That's political capital right there. And so from that perspective, I would say that, yeah, this year they're sort of staking out that outlier. What's interesting to me is that it would make the weekend in review, because I got to say that usually a number of people have actually said the same to me. They're totally into, why would they have done John Grant? This is incredible. Almost as incredible as Jin Young for the 45th district.
Right, the Republican in the 45th.
Yes. Yeah. People are just like, what? What are they doing? What are they thinking? Outlier. They're trying for the outlier position.
Coming up on the Week in Review, the Me Too hashtag meets the How I Will Change hashtag. Also, paying for every mile you drive, paying a tax instead of paying by the gallon, and more coming up on the Week in Review.
I say no. We've got the men like a puppet show. We need me. It's the people that say men are leading the women to stay. I say it's the wheel of your day. It's one of them the men.
The Week in Review. Bill Radke here. We're on Twitter at KUOW. I'm with Zeki Barak Hamid and Kathy Allen and Rob McKenna. We're figuring out what happened this week and why it matters. And this week, Harvey Weinstein's Hollywood buddy Quentin Tarantino said he's known for decades about Weinstein's alleged assaults and harassment of women. And Tarantino says he feels ashamed that he didn't take a stronger stand. He says he should have stopped working with Weinstein, though he didn't say what he'll do with the money he earned by having continued to work with the company that Weinstein built. Also this week, Olympic gold medalist Michaela Maroney accused the USA Gymnastics women's team doctor of sexually abusing her all through her teenage years. The Twitter hashtag MeToo is about how widespread rape and sexual harassment are. I've heard that maybe one in four women has been sexually abused, which means not one in four men exactly, but what? One in five, seven, and you don't see a lot of men coming out as rapists or harassers or even complicit, more staying silent like Quentin Tarantino says he did. So, Kathy, does this actually feel like a culture shift or not to you?
It's hard to say this is a culture shift when we've had this cultural shift before and before and before. There's a part of everyone that likes to think that because it happened either on Hollywood or it happened in a high political place, that usually that has been enough to actually get the folks to actually say, let's do something about it. But what's happening right now is that there are just so many folks that are coming forward and saying, this cannot happen. We cannot allow this to happen. The thing that's of a disservice to every woman is the fact that the number of people who have known about it or someone who's actually come to you and said something, the fact that if a cop gets it or it's been part of an investigation, that there has always been this willingness to let it go. I mean, it's just boys will be boys. And, you know, if she doesn't really want to file the complaint, why do we make her? The fact is, I think women are just saying, enough of this, for gosh sakes. This is not right. And this should have been taken care of a long time ago. We shouldn't still be arguing this point. This should have happened decades ago.
The Me Too hashtag has been tweeted more than 12 million times. Some men are responding with the hashtag, how I will change. Zeki, how significant do you think that is?
There are a couple of things about this. The first one is I'm surprised, or maybe I shouldn't be surprised, how quickly the conversation went from listening to women to about making it about us men. It came really quickly. And I understand that how I will change, that's really good. But you can't go there from one day to another. You have to have a period of really listening. I mean, so start by the women in your lives. Go to your wife, go to your sisters, your mothers, and really listen. That's what I'm trying to do right now, to really listen about what their experience is every day. And then after I finish doing that, if there is such a thing as finish, because I have to continually do it, but I have to reflect on this. I have to allow a space for myself to really reflect on what that means and really question my daily choices. What music am I listening to? What kind of media am I consuming? Is this wrong? Am I being silent with things? I had an experience in grad school that is just haunting me right now, and it kind of came back now. That was back in 2001. And I went to grad school in Delaware, and we were sitting in a green room. And there was a guy that essentially got kicked out of our program because he was a serial harasser. Mm-hmm. And he was on top of one of these women, you know, thinking he's having fun and all of that. I seriously can't remember what I did that day. I just remember the other woman in there pushing him off and saying, get off her, dude. So I reached out to both of them, a few days ago and said, look, I am so sorry because I really don't remember. I want to be the good guy that did something, but I really don't think I did. And, you know, both of them were very gracious in their responses, and they couldn't remember either. But that's just haunting me right now. Did I just see that and not do anything about it? That's making me question everything.
I think that this first of all, it's a really powerful story. Thank you. And really, really thought-provoking. Secondly, I think this episode with Weinstein, everything that's come from it, could be a pivot point, not to solving the problem, because human nature just doesn't change that fast, but to taking another step forward. It reminds me a bit of the steps we've taken forward on the issue of domestic violence, in the sense that we're now willing to talk about it. Victims and survivors are more willing to come out and speak out about it. We have not enough services, but we have services now that completely did not exist 30, 40 years ago, et cetera. It's like human trafficking, where people didn't even know what human trafficking was until relatively recently, when now people are actively talking about what human trafficking means and the victims that are trafficked into the sex trade and the labor trade and so forth. So I hope this is a pivot point that moves us a step forward. I think that men stepping up to it is important. Just like in the domestic violence prevention movement, we often talk about how men need to be voices for it, mm-hmm. because it's men that are committing most of the domestic violence acts. Mm-hmm. And I think it's valuable that this happened in Hollywood, quite frankly, because for whatever reason in our culture, we put a lot of value on those people who show up on small screens and silver screens. And if that's what it takes, so be it.
I have a question for Rob before I want to hear from both of you. But former Attorney General Rob McKenna, we have a statute of limitations on sexual assaults in Washington State. Should that change? Not all states do. It's Harvey Weinstein's home state of New York doesn't have that.
It's a policy that the legislature should revisit and reconsider. They may choose to change it or not.
What do you think?
But they. I think that it's worth considering for sure. That it's lengthening it, eliminating it becomes problematic because they become roll up problems of proof later on. There are reasons.
Well, why can't that play out in the courtroom or in sentencing?
Well, it can, but there are good reasons that you have a statute of limitations on most crimes. And I'm just speaking realistically and practically for on behalf of prosecutors and defense lawyers and others.
I wouldn't be advising that as a political person. I would say that right now what's happening is, first of all, the domestic violence community, as well as I think real people don't really, the real neighbors just say to themselves, well, what if a person hasn't been able to open their mouth for 20 years.
Well, that's why we took the statute of limitations off other serious crimes, child rape, I think, where we've extended it where it's a certain number of years after you come of age.
But so not for women.
Well, I'm not saying they shouldn't. I did say just now it should be considered for sure. I'm just trying to explain in general why there are statutes of limitations. So there should be a thorough policy debate and consideration of all the factors. This might be one of those where indeed it should be raised. I doubt that it should be eliminated altogether. There are very few crimes where there is no statute of limitations. Murder, of course, is the most prominent. But in other cases, we are concerned about the practical ability to prosecute cases successfully with evidence that's still available. That's why we have them. That's all I'm saying.
Well, Weinstein, speaking of the legal system, Weinstein denies any non-consensual sex. Does non-consensual sex legally have to mean proven physical force? Does the legal system take into account I'm rich and powerful? You know, any of those factors, you'll never work in this town again?
There are two dimensions to the legal system, of course, criminal and civil. On the criminal side, there are standards for what constitutes sexual assault and what doesn't. But those matters that don't rise to the level of sexual assault because the woman was coerced into consenting are still ripe for civil action. And that's another part of this. And you don't have a statute of limitations issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm looking at it from, a cultural point of view. And this is universal. I mean, there was a UN report that was done in Egypt about sexual harassment there. 99.3% of Egyptian women reported being sexually harassed. 99.3%. And then 96.5%, according to the same UN report, said that they have experienced unwelcome touch. This is universal. And it's really interesting because it negates the idea that if you don't dress provocatively, then you're not going to get harassed. You look at Egyptian society right now, and it's gotten, very much more conservative over the years, and it's still happening. I remember this. I remember in high school, I was in sixth grade. I had a guy in my class that would try to brush up against the teacher, and she wore a hijab. This is universal. This is an absolute epidemic, and I believe that those of us in positions of power and influence owe it to ourselves and everybody else to address this. So in my programs, as a program director at Humanities Washington, I have to address these in who I decide to put on the panel to speak, what kind of programs I'm doing. And I also teach at Everett Community College. I address this with my students on Monday. We talked about everything from the Bechdel test in movies and TV.
Bechdel test is there needs to be at least two women.
Yeah, there are three main rules characters. At least two women that have names and lines. They have to talk to each other, and they have to talk to each other about something other than a man.
Right, right.
So you'll be surprised. A lot of movies don't pass that.
Well, here's an example. A male friend of mine sent me a sort of jokey text, including the idea that the Harvey Weinstein story is overblown. And in the text conversation, I brought his sister into it. How would you want her to be treated? But I kept the light tone that he was using. Would it have been better for me to scold him or just like, hey, man, I changed the tone in the text message. Instead, I was like, mm-hmm. Talking his language. Was that wrong, do you think?
Yeah, it is. You have to draw a line in the sand. Enough is enough. I mean, if he thinks that this is funny or overblown, talk to the women. Talk to the women that have experienced this. Because if you do that, then you clearly don't believe that women are equal to you.
I think that one of those things that I get a lot now is, so what do we do about this? And I always say, well, you can start with those dirty jokes, or you can start with those calendars you have on the wall, or you can start with, looking at my eyes as opposed to my neckline. Give me a break. I mean, the fact is that this has become part of what is acceptable behavior, and it's not just something that's going to go away in 3 months. It's frankly, every person can do better.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, the solution is cultural. It's in behavioral norms and people's willingness to adhere to those norms. You can't solve this problem through the legal system, civil or criminal. Yeah. It has to be fundamental at the cultural level, and we're a long way away from that in the society. That was really driven home to me, for example, when I started work on human trafficking as Attorney General, when I ran into this idea that, prostitution, that's that's not human trafficking. That's just a bilateral transaction. That's the happy hooker making a good living because she chooses to do so. And we glorify that in Hollywood and elsewhere. And
hooker
it's
with
just,
a heart of gold.
Yeah, right. And it's just wrong. I mean, the average age of girls being introduced into prostitution in this country is around 12 years old now. And, of course, they're not volunteering for it. And yet we have this cultural mindset that somehow prostitution is okay because the woman is being paid, or in some cases the boy is being paid. And that you have to solve that at a cultural level. There'll never be enough law enforcement resources in the world to solve it.
Well, I'll take that on. Thank you. And we'll see what changes we can actually track as Harvey Weinstein, will he be in the rearview mirror or not? Coming up on the Week in Review, we're going to talk about paying a tax by the mile instead of by the gallon. We're going to talk about congestion pricing this city like London does with that city. Coming up in just a moment. Now I'm considering swerving because I was going to talk all about gas tax, but you guys are obviously heated about the fact if we had time, we were going to talk about the fact that the Boy Scouts are talking about allowing, is that the word, about having
taking over? Mm-hmm.
Taking over. Well, this is the question. The Boy Scouts are saying that they will have girl members. In their troops,
we
right?
Already, well, look, we already have girls in Explorer Posts, which is the Boy Scouts of America program, and in Venture Cruise.
Rob McKenna is on that. You're on the board of the Boy Scouts,
and
right?
And I'm an Eagle Scout, and I've been very active in scouting entire life since I was 12 years old.
Yeah.
That what's happened is this policy change is the result of parents asking for the change. This wasn't externally imposed. There have been lots of families asking for a long time that their girls be allowed to participate in Cub Scouts and then in Boy Scouts. My friend Scott Oakey, who's been on the board with me at Chief Saddle Council for a long time, has two sons who are Eagle Scouts, and he started asking the question at least 5 years ago, why can't my daughter become an Eagle Scout?
Okay,
so that's what this is responding to.
Kathy, what's wrong with that?
Well, among other things, you have an entire generation and generation of women who have been in Girl Scouts that look at this, obviously, for all the work they've done and all of the fact that they've been increasing in the number of girls that have been joining substantially, and the Boy Scouts have been decreasing substantially. In all of that, what it just looks to me is like this is an opportunity to be able to actually kind of squelch it. I was suggesting that we do something like calling it the Girls and Boys Club. Girls and Boy Scouts. And as a former Girl Scout that was really angry when we found out that only boys could have this accolade called Eagle Scout. And oh, by the way, the number of politicians, Rob included, Gary Locke included, the number of guys who list on their credentials to run for office Eagle Scout drives me nuts. Drives me nuts. Girls
and what does
don't
that
have that.
Yeah,
girls
go on.
Girls don't have that opportunity.
Have the Gold Award. I had two Girl Scouts, my daughters, and that's the Girl Scouts decision. It's a separate organization, and they can do what they want. But the fact is that a lot of families in scouting, whose girls maybe were in Venture Cruise, maybe were in Explorers, but couldn't get into Cub Scouts, now will have the opportunity to form all girl dens. That are part of Cub Scout packs, and then ultimately to form troops that are in the initial policy that are composed of girls, to have the same access to the outdoor opportunities and the leadership development opportunities. That
and they can be Eagle Scouts, right?
And then they can advance to the rank. Like, I don't know why.
Kathy, what does it take away from Girl Scouts?
Well, it just simply means that if you have a chance to go on to be Eagle Scouts, it's this again. I hate to say this, but this is another situation of money. I mean, despite the fact that there are more women in Girl Scouts, the fact is there's the Boy Scouts are a whole lot more. There's a whole lot more money there. And actually, Eagle Scouts are very good givers, too. Actually, Boy Scouts, they go back and actually give. But my point is that, it doesn't look altruistic to me at all. It seems to me I worry about the Girl Scouts in terms of the work that they've been doing for years and years and years. And my thinking is that this is another situation where I think they try to make the Girl Scouts look like, well, you should just join the Boy Scouts. Why not just join us?
What do you think, Zaki?
I'm a big fan of the Girl Scouts. I don't know much about the Boy Scouts. But what I worry about is how much does the Boy Scouts know about women empowerment? And is there they're just going to be absorbed in there? Because the Girl Scouts does a really good job of empowering women. And there's something to be said for a space of women only or girls only to come together for this kind of leadership development. And I would be afraid that that would be lost in if girls were allowed into
the Girl Scouts. Girl Scouts will still be available. I don't understand why the biggest opposition to this is coming from the Girl Scouts. I mean, there are over 1.3 million boys and girls involved in the Boy Scouts of America today, including in the co-ed programs. So, now girls will have more options than ever before, and I think that's a good thing.
In the minute and a half we have left since I opened this can, does anyone feel uncomfortable? We have girls' schools. We have boys' schools. Does anyone feel uncomfortable with the gender segregation that we're advocating here?
I think gender segregation is maybe a good thing. There's a lot of studies that have shown that when girls go to all girls schools, they perform better. And I think there's something to be said for that. I don't know everything about it, but if I could afford a private school for my daughter when she grows up, all girls school, I probably would seriously consider it.
I think that what's happening is that it's much better for girls and it's probably much worse for boys, that the guys are the ones who probably need to look at women as a friend, partner, playmate, and all of this, so that they don't grow up and actually become part of fraternities that are either hazing or beating on girls, and more importantly, that they don't grow up to be Harvey Weinsteins.
We've got to pause there. The Week in Review has flown by with Zeki Barak Hamid, director at Humanities Washington, Kathy Allen, political consultant, founder and president of the Connections Group. Rob McKenna is former Attorney General of Washington. You're saying I shouldn't say and Eagle Scout?
Well, no, I suppose he can do it here.
Yeah, okay.
Thanks, Kathy.
We're on Twitter @KOW. I love you all. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.